last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Now, it's reckoned that at least 10,000 women and girls were essentially imprisoned in Ireland's Magdalen laundries, forced into unpaid labour, subject to much cruelty and suffering. And if you think that this was very much just a 20th century story, remember that the last Magdalen laundry only closed 30 years ago in 1996. And many of the women and children who went through the Magdalen laundries are still alive and still very much remember their experiences. There is a major TV documentary on tomorrow evening on RTE. It's already been screened elsewhere as a feature-length documentary. It's called Testimony and it is directed by Aoife Kelleher. We have two contributors to Testimony with us this evening here on The Last Word. We're joined by Dr. Maeve O'Rourke, who is a human rights lawyer from the University of Galway, and also by Dr. Mary Harney, a survivor of one of the mother and baby homes who recently completed her doctorate in human rights. You're both very welcome to The Last Word. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
Dr. Mary Harney, if I can start with you, please, first. Can you maybe just tell me a little bit, please, about your story?
My story is that I was born in 1949 in Bessborough, mother and baby institution. And I was with my mother there for 2.5 years. And then I was taken away from her at a half an hour's notice. She had not signed any documents. And I was fostered or boarded out to an elderly couple who consequently had neglected me and also abused me physically. And then the cruelty man, or the prevention of cruelty to children officer, took me from them. I was taken to Cork, the courthouse in Cork, where the judge sentenced me to the Good Shepherd's Industrial School in Cork until I was 16. So that's basically my life in a nutshell in the institutions.
Can I just run through that again? So what age were you when you were separated from your mother? Did you have any, were you old enough to have any memories of her?
No, I was 2.5 when I was taken from her. So I didn't remember her. When I was taken away from the institution, although it was an institution, the dormitories where the babies were kept were full of light and, airy. They were big dormitories. And then when I was taken to the foster parents, it was a small, dark, two up, two down house. And I was always terrified there.
How long were you with them? And did you ever find out why it was they were chosen to foster you?
Well, I did find out. And it turns out that the foster mother had a connection to one of the nuns in Bessborough. And they were chums, I think you'd call them, and was able to, even though they were in their, I would say, probably mid-50s, my mother was only 22 at that time, I was just handed over to them, and, simply because one of the nuns, they had asked for a child, and one of the nuns thought, we'll give him Mary.
And then when you went to the Good Shepherd Convent, was that the one on Sunday as well in Cork?
That's right, yes.
Okay, I know it because I grew up very near to it and everybody was very much imprisoned in there, I remember. So what age were you when you went in there and what was that like, the years that you spent there?
Yeah, I was almost 5 when I went there. So I'd been with the foster parents for 2.5 years and I'd already gone to school in the South Press. So I went up there to the Good Shepherds when I was almost five. And from then on, as you say, it was incarceration until I was supposed to come out, according to the judge, at 16. But the nuns had that extended for another six months. So again, against the judge's rulings, you know, the nuns decided they would hold on to me. And during that time, I was educated by the nuns to have a minimum degree, I would say. Mostly it was the three R's, religion, religion, and religion, and a lot of physical work and a lot of punishments and, as you say, incarceration. We couldn't go out on our own. We weren't free to do anything except breathe.
And that went on for over a decade for you, effectively child slave labor.
Yeah, I did some research when I did my master's on that same thing. And I asked that question, you know, that was my research question. And the answer is yes, it was forced labor. If you look at the UN conventions and the International Labor Organization's, convention on forced labor. Yes, it was. We did everything. We worked with toxic chemicals in cleaning. We worked in a bakery. We had a bakery. We worked in the cemetery cleaning the headstones of the nuns. And we had our own shoemaking shop, and we had a smaller laundry than the Magdalens, but we were connected in that way with the Magdalens. And also we did copious amounts of cleaning and polishing and scrubbing on our hands and knees.
Mary, did anyone ever show you any affection, even love, as you were growing up as a child?
I think my mother was probably the last person to hold me with love, because whenever the nuns picked me up as a child, it was usually to give me a slap for something or to punish me in some way. So no, although we did have some good nuns who did not engage in, hitting children or punishing them by putting them in dark rooms and stuff like that, they also did not stand up for us when we were being beaten. So, you know, I still have marks on my face and in my head from some of those beatings.
When you did get released from this form of imprisonment, how prepared were you for adult life outside the convent?
Not at all. Didn't even know the facts of life. And, people talk about the cycle of institutionalization, where these young women left the institutions and quickly became pregnant or ended up in Magdalen laundries for some sort of misdemeanors in social, or because they were too attractive, or because they flirted with boys. But we were not prepared for any of that. We couldn't manage money, you know, we didn't know anything about paying rent. We literally survived, you know, the best we could. And we learned as we went along.
What did you do? Where did you go?
Well, first of all, I was the nuns would get us jobs, and usually they were menial jobs. And even though I had been to secondary school, I still ended up in a hotel cleaning toilets and bathrooms. And many of us did. We were assigned to the Bon Secours Hospital in Cork or other institutions where we were living in, as it were. But those places didn't pay us proper wages, or, you know, we had small, tiny little rooms. We didn't know we were free. That was one of the big issues.
Indeed, when did you start to realise that a great injustice had been done to you?
Well, when I went looking for a birth certificate, I can't remember why I needed it or wanted it. And I found when I was 11 years, about 12, doing my confirmation, the nuns had told me that, as they put it, my real mother was dead. And so I believed that, and I used to pray for her soul every night. And I found out when I was released that my mother was not dead, with the help of a priest from the Sacred Heart Missionaries down there in Cork. He helped me by telling me, no, he called the Bessborough nuns, and he found out that my mother was living in the UK, was married, and, that I was flabbergasted, absolutely, that my mother was alive all that time, and there I was praying for her soul.
And then what happened when you met with her?
It was a really weird meeting, because in my head I dreamed that I'd have a mother that was probably like, out of the movies, out of the films, because we'd seen old films where, Greta Garbo, Betty Davis, So I had that kind of an idea in my head. And on the day I met my mother, she's very much like me. She's short and stout, and was like me. And in my head, I was going, oh, no, this is not my mother. This is the wrong woman. And she came with her husband and my two half-sisters to see me. And then I decided after a couple of weeks to go and live with her to experience a family.
How did that work out?
No, it didn't. It did. I loved my mother, but I went from an institution into an ordinary family, working class family home. And it was almost like the walls closed in on me. I couldn't cope. I couldn't socialize. I wasn't prepared. And so I left home and joined the British Army. Don't tell anybody.
Okay. I want to bring in Maeve O'Rourke, human rights lawyer, who's a major contributor to the Testimony documentary. Maeve, Mary's story is unique to her. However, there are so many stories that are similar, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. So you opened by discussing the Magdalen Laundries, but as we've just heard from Mary, they were part of a system that also included mother and baby institutions, the boarding out system, the adoption system, the county homes, the residential schools, the psychiatric institutions. And it's estimated that by 1951, more than 1% of the Irish population was incarcerated in one institution or another, and a very small proportion of that being prison. And only last week we had the release of the Truth Recovery Independent Panel report on Northern Ireland's Magdalen and mother and baby institutions. And we can see a very similar system there, but not only that it was actually cross-border. So lots of traffic between institutions and also across the border. So yes, it's an enormous system that really continues to affect, I think, hundreds of thousands of people really today.
Well, that's what I was just about to say. I introduced this by saying at least 10,000 women and girls in the Magdalen Laundries. But when you take in all of these other institutions that you have mentioned, that number just multiplies very, very quickly.
Absolutely, especially considering the adoption and the informal adoption system. And then, of course, all of the intergenerational effects of that, and the fact that the abuse itself of family separation through these institutions, denial of identity, it continues into the present day. So it's not even a historic abuse. I'm sure many of the listeners are aware of what's happening in Bessborough at the moment, and there are still mothers and siblings of babies who died in their hundreds whose burial place is not known. So this is not a historic abuse and it absolutely affects huge numbers of people.
What would you like to see happen in relation to the Bessborough home, which has been shut down and which I think now is earmarked for a housing development?
Yeah, it needs to be CPO'd by the Irish government. In fact, in the 1970s, two-thirds of the Bessborough estate was CPO'd. It's now a road and an industrial estate, but 60 acres of that is still in private ownership. Of course, the problem, and I suppose the reason for such extensive abuse, was that the care, quote-unquote, of women and girls and children was privatised and the state didn't exercise proper supervision in the past. And now these lands and these institutional buildings are still in private hands and are being used for, you know, in the case of Bessborough, development for commercial gain, I suppose. But whatever about that, in the proper circumstances, it's being done while 859 babies' whereabouts are unknown and 19 of the mothers who died there as well, their whereabouts are unknown. So the state did not properly investigate the whereabouts of these hundreds and hundreds of babies. The Mother and Baby Homes Commission actually didn't do any geophysical surveys of the Bessborough site, those 60 acres that are still there, or any test trenching. And yet, the government, the Taoiseach, the Minister for Children are saying we've done an extensive investigation and now it's just in the hands of planners. But actually, there is definitely a growing public movement demanding a CPO of the remaining site.
Maeve, does that speak to perhaps the fact that we've had in recent decades many apologies from the state, admission of wrongdoing and of neglect, and we've had various judgments against religious orders and others about paying compensation for what has happened. But yet, despite all of that, that there are still these enormous lacunas in what has been done for the people who were the victims of what happened, and that many people went to their graves without getting proper recognition or proper help and assistance, and that there are still people out there who perhaps feel that still not enough has been done in recompense.
Absolutely, and they would be right in feeling that way. And I think maybe the government just hasn't really grasped or wanted to grasp the complexity of the abuse and its ongoing implications, and therefore the range of measures that are needed. Like, it's not just enough to issue a state apology and to set up a payment scheme that actually, at the present moment, excludes most people who were born in mother and baby institutions. It's not enough to do that. You have to also fully investigate the whereabouts of the disappeared. You have to ensure proper health and social care for people who are now aging so that they are not reinstitutionalized in nursing homes. You actually have to ensure full family tracing is available to people and total access to records. And these issues haven't been dealt with appropriately yet.
Just to finish up, Dr. Mary Harney, as a survivor and as somebody who was born in Bessborough, how did the rest of your life go when you had all of these memories of your childhood and your teenage years and difficult early adult years? What was it like for you growing up with all of that and making your way in life?
Well, it wasn't plain sailing. The one thing, I guess, that I regretted most of all, or that bothered me most of all, was that I didn't have an education or develop according to my intelligence, you know. And so for years, I fought to educate myself. I think a lot of people who know me know that I started off by talking my way into college in America, and ever since then I've pursued my education. But it goes deeper than that for me, because my struggles to be educated also meant, of course, that I had to work to raise the money to do all of that. And I wasn't prepared in a lot of ways. And then I think the effects of the trauma, psychological and physical, became, I developed PTSD, and so it's been hard. But the issue around education is that I've continued to work towards educating other people about, and the documentary testimony will help to do this too, about what happens and about how human rights were violated deliberately by the state. And people often talk about the religious orders, but they forget there was a collusion with the state. The state was responsible for the institutions. And now I work towards educating younger people, because they are our future. And also the Human Rights Law Clinic in the University of Galway, the students there have taken on a lot of responsibility for educating in schools. And for the first time in Irish history last year, the Department of Education rolled out three strands that teach the history of the institutions. But it's taken all this time, 2025, to get this on the curricula. So, you know, we go into schools and we help wherever schools need us. And we keep continuing to educate people. And testimony has done a great job with opening that up for us and to keep educating the public that justice has not been achieved. And like Maeve said, we have to continue with the compulsory purchase order and locating the disappeared and reuniting families. And that all takes education.
Testimony is on RTE1 television 9:35 tomorrow evening, and if you don't get it there, you'll be able to get it afterwards on the RTE player. Dr. Mary Harney, thank you very much for telling us about your story, and Dr. Maeve O'Rourke from University of Galway.
The last word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.